at its edges, strewn with white chrysanthemums. I call Paul in Virginia. He makes a request I don't expect, and asks to see her. I take my laptop and carry it the few yards toward the graves, close enough to the house to obtain 3 bars of Wi-Fi. I stand, the laptop held out in front of me, and point Paul's face to Lon's grave, which is embossed with a photo of her when she was 28, roughly the age when they first met. I wait from behind the screen as this American veteran Skypes with his estranged Vietnamese ex-wife, just buried. At one point, I think the signal had cut out, but then I hear Paul blowing his nose, his sentences amputated, struggling through his goodbyes. "He's sorry," he says to the smiling face on the grave. Sorry that he went back to Virginia in 71 after he received notice that his mother was ill. How it was all a ploy to get him home. How his mother faked her tuberculosis until weeks turned to months, until the war began to close and Nixon stopped deploying troops and Americans started pulling out. How all the letters Lon sent were intercepted by Paul's brother. How it wasn't until one day, months before Saigon fell, a soldier just home knocked on his door and handed him a note from Lon. How Lon and their daughters had to leave the capital after the fall. How they'll write again. He said sorry that it took so long. That by the time the Salvation Army called him to let him know there was a woman with a marriage certificate with his name on it looking for him in a Philippine refugee camp, it was already 1990. He had, by then, been married to another woman for over 8 years. He says all this in a flood of stuttered Vietnamese, which he picked up during his tour and kept at through their marriage, until his words are barely coherent under his heaving. A few children from the village had gathered at the edge of the graves. Their curious and perplexed stares hover on the periphery. I must look strange to them, holding the pixelated head of a white man in front of a row of tombs. As I look at Paul's face on the screen, the soft-spoken man, the stranger turned grandfather turned family, I realize how little I know of us, of my country, any country. Standing by the dirt road, not unlike the road Lon had once stood on nearly 40 years earlier, an M16 pointed at her nose as she held you. I wait until my grandpa's voice, this retired tutor, vegan, and marijuana grower, this lover of maps and Camus, finishes his last words to his first love, then closed the laptop. In the Hartford I grew up in, and the one you grow old in, we greet one another not with hello or how are you, but by asking, our chins jabbing the air, what's good? I've heard this said in other parts of the country, but in Hartford, it was pervasive. Among those hollowed out, boarded buildings, playgrounds with barbed wire fences so rusted and twisted out of shape, they were like something made out of nature, organic as vines, we made a lexicon for ourselves. A phrase used by the economic losers. It can also be heard in East Hartford and New Britain, where entire white families, the ones some call trailer trash, cram themselves on half-broken porches in mobile parks and HUD housing, their faces oxycontin gaunt under cigarette smoke, illuminated by flashlights hung by fishing lines in lieu of porch lights, howling, "What's good?" as you walked by. In my Hartford, where fathers were phantoms, dipping in and out of their children's lives, like my own father, where grandmothers, abuelas, abbas, nanas, babas, and bawais were kings, crowned with nothing but salvaged and improvised pride, and the stubborn testament of their tongues as they waited on creaking knees and bloated feet outside social services for heat and oil assistance, smelling of drugstore perfume and peppermint hard candies. Their brown, oversized Goodwill coats dusted with fresh snow as they huddled, steaming down the winter block. Their sons and daughters at work or in jail or overdosed or just gone, hitching cross-country on greyhounds with dreams of kicking the habit, starting anew, but then ghosting into family legends. In my Hartford, where the insurance companies that made us the big city had all moved out once the internet arrived, and our best minds were sucked up by New York or Boston, where everybody's second cousin was in the Latin Kings, where we still sell Whalers jerseys at the bus station 20 years after the Whalers ditched this place to become the Carolina Hurricanes. Hartford of Mark Twain, Wallace Stevens, and Harriet Beecher Stowe. Writers whose vast imaginations failed to hold in either flesh or ink bodies like ours. Where the Bushnell Theater, the Wadsworth Athenaeum, which held the first retrospective on Picasso in America, were visited mostly by outsiders from the suburbs, who park their cars valet and hurry into the warm auditorium halogens before driving home to sleepy towns flushed with Pier 1 imports and Whole Foods. Hartford, where we stayed when other Vietnamese immigrants fled to California or Houston, where we made a kind of life digging in and out of one brutal winter after another, where nor'easters swallowed our cars overnight. The 2 a.m. gunshots, the 2 p.m. gunshots, the wives and girlfriends at the Seatown checkout with black eyes and cut lips who return your gaze with lifted chins as if to say, mind your business. Because being knocked down was already understood, already a given. It was the skin you wore. To ask what's good was to move right away to joy. It was pushing aside what was inevitable to reach the exceptional. Not great or well or wonderful, but simply good. Because good was more often enough. Was a precious spark we sought and harvested of and for one another. Here, good is finding a dollar caught in the sewer drain. Is when your mom has enough money on your birthday to rent a movie, plus buy a $5 pizza from Easy Frank's and stick 8 candles over the melted cheese and pepperoni. Good is knowing there was a shooting and your brother was the one that came home, or was already beside you, tucked into a bowl of mac and cheese. That's what Trevor said to me that night as we climbed out of the river. The black droplets dripping from our hair and fingertips. His arm slung across my shivering shoulder. He put his mouth to my ear and said, "You good? You heard, little dog? You good, I swear. You good." After we put Lon's urn in the ground, polished her grave one last time with cloth rags soaked in wax and castor oil, you and I returned to our hotel in Saigon. Soon as we enter the dingy room with its choking air conditioner, you turn off all the lights. I stop mid-stride, not sure what to make of the sudden dark. It's early afternoon, and the motorbikes can still be heard honking and puttering on the street below. The bed creaks. You had sat down. "Where am I?" you say. "Where is this?" Not knowing what else to say, I say your name. "Rose," I say. "The flower, the color, the shade." "Hong," I repeat. "A flower is seen only toward the end of its life, just bloomed and already on its way to being brown paper. And maybe all names are illusions. How often do we name something after its briefest form? Rosebush," rain, butterfly, snapping turtle, firing squad, childhood, deaf, mother tongue, me, you. Only when I utter the word do I realize that rose is also the past tense of rise. That in calling your name, I am also telling you to get up. I say it as if it is the only answer to your question. As if a name is also a sound we can be found in. Where am I? Where am I? Your rose, Ma. You have risen. I touch your shoulder with the gentleness Trevor showed me back in the river. Trevor who, wild as he was, wouldn't eat veal, wouldn't eat the children of cows. I think now about those children, taken from their mothers and placed in boxes the size of their lives, to be fed and fattened into soft meat. I am thinking of freedom again. How the calf is most free when the cage opens and it's led to the truck for slaughter. All freedom is relative. You know too well. And sometimes it's no freedom at all, but simply the cage widening far away from you. The bars abstracted with distance, but still there. As when they free wild animals into nature preserves, only to contain them yet again by larger borders. But I took it anyway, that widening, because sometimes not seeing the bars is enough. For a few delirious moments in the barn, as Trevor and I fucked, the cage around me became invisible, even if I knew it was never gone. How my elation became a trap when I lost control of my inner self. How waste, shit, excess is what binds the living, yet is always present and perennial in death. When the calves are finally butchered, surrendering their insides is often their final act, their bowels shocked from the sudden velocity of endings. I squeeze your wrist and say, your name. I look at you and see, through the pitch dark, Trevor's eyes. Trevor, whose face has, by now, already begun to blur in my mind. How they burned under the barn lamp as we dressed, shuddering quietly from the water. I see Lan's eyes in her last hours, like needful drops of water. How they were all she could move. Like the calf's wide pupils as the latch is opened and it charges from its prison toward the man with a harness ready to loop around its neck. Where am I, little dog? Your rose, your lawn, your Trevor. As if a name can be more than one thing, deep and wide as a night with a truck idling at its edge. And you can step right out of your cage, where I wait for you. Where, under the stars, we see at last what we've made of each other in the light of long dead things. And call it good. I remember the table. I remember the table made of words given to me from your mouth. I remember the room burning. The room was burning because Lan spoke of fire. I remember the fire as it was told to me in the apartment in Hartford. All of us asleep on the hardwood floor, swaddled in blankets from the Salvation Army. I remember the man from the Salvation Army handing my father a stack of coupons for Kentucky Fried Chicken, which we called Old Man Chicken. Colonel Sanders' face was plastered on every red bucket. I remember tearing into the crispy meat and oil like it was a gift from saints. I remember learning that saints were only people whose pain was notable, noted. I remember thinking you and Lon should be saints. Remember, you said each morning before we stepped out in cold Connecticut air. Don't draw attention to yourself. You're already Vietnamese. It's the first day of August, and the sky's clear over central Virginia, now thick with summer's growth. We're visiting Grandpa Paul to celebrate my graduating college the spring before. We're in the garden. The first colors of evening fall upon the wooden fence, and everything ambers, as if we're in a snow globe filled with tea. You're in front of me, walking away toward the far fence, your pink shirt shifting in and out of the shade. It catches, then loses the shadows under the oaks. I remember my father, which is to say I am putting him back together. I am putting him together in a room because there must have been a room. There must have been a square in which a life would occur briefly, with or without joy. I remember joy. It was the sound of coins in a brown paper bag, his wages after a day scaling fish at the Chinese market on Cortland. I remember the coins spilling onto the floor, how we ran our fingers through the cold pieces, inhaling their copper promise, how we thought we were rich, how the thought of being rich was a kind of happiness. I remember the table, how it must have been made of wood. The garden is so lush, it seems to pulse in the weak light. Vegetation fills every inch of it, tomato vines robust enough to hide the chicken wire they lean on, wheatgrass and kale crowded in galvanized tubs the size of canoes. The flowers I know now by name. Magnolias, asters, poppies, marigolds, baby's breath, all of it, every shade equalized by dusk. What are we, if not what the light says we are? Your pink shirt glows ahead of me. Crouched, your back poised as you study something on the ground between your feet. You brush your hair behind your ears, pause, study it closer. Only the seconds move between us. A swarm of gnats, a veil suspended over no one's face. Everything here seems to have just finished overflowing, resting at last, spent and spilled from the summer's frothing. I walk toward you. I remember walking with you to the grocery store, my father's wages in your hands. How, by then, he had beaten you only twice, which meant there was still hope it would be the last. I remember armfuls of Wonder Bread and jars of mayo, how you thought mayo was butter, how in Saigon, butter and white bread were only eaten inside mansions guarded by butlers and steel gates. I remember everyone smiling back at the apartment, mayonnaise sandwiches raised to cracked lips. I remember thinking we lived in a sort of mansion. I remember thinking this was the American dream, as snow crackled against the window and night came, and we lay down to sleep side by side, limbs tangled as the sirens wailed through the streets, our bellies full of bread and butter. Inside the house, Paul is in the kitchen, bent over a bowl of pesto. Thick, shiny basil leaves, machete-crushed garlic cloves, pine nuts, onions roasted till their gold edges blacken, and the bright scent of lemon zest. His glasses fog as he leans in, struggling to steady his arthritic hand as he pours the steaming pasta over the mixture. A few gentle tosses with two wooden spoons, and the bow ties are bathed in a moss-green sauce. The windows in the kitchen sweat, replacing the view of the garden with an empty movie screen. It is time to call the boy and his mother in. But Paul lingers for a while, watches the blank canvas, a man with nothing, finally, in his hands, waiting for everything to start. I remember the table, which is to say I am putting it together, because someone opened their mouth and built a structure with words, and now I am doing the same each time I see my hands and think table, think beginnings. I remember running my fingers along the edges, studying the bolts and washers I created in my mind. I remember crawling underneath, checking for chewed gum, the names of lovers, but finding only bits of dried blood, splinters. I remember this beast with four legs hammered out of a language not yet my own. A butterfly, pinked by the hour, lands on a blade of sweet grass, then flits off. The blade twitches once, then stills. The butterfly tumbles the length of the yard, its wings resembling that corner of Toni Morrison's Sula. I dog-eared so many times the tiny ear broke off one morning in New York, fluttered down the liquid winter avenue. It was a part where Eva pours gasoline on her drug-doomed son and lights the match in an act of love and mercy I hope to both be capable of and never know. I squint. It's not a monarch, just a weak white blur, ready to die in the first frost. But I know the monarchs are close by, their orange and black wings folded, dusted, and baked by heat, ready to flee south. Strand by strand, twilight stitches our edges deep red. One night back in Saigon, 2 days after we buried Lan, I heard the sound of tinny music and the pitched voice of children through the hotel balcony. It was nearly 2 in the morning. You were still asleep on the mattress beside me. I got up, slipped on my sandals, and walked out. The hotel was in an alley, my eyes adjusting to the fluorescent tube lights hung along the wall. I made my way toward the music. The night blazed up before me. People were suddenly everywhere, a kaleidoscope of colors, garments, limbs, the glint of jewelry and sequins. Vendors were selling fresh coconuts, cut mangoes, rice cakes pressed into gooey masses wrapped in banana leaves and steamed in large metal vats, sugarcane juice sold in sandwich bags cut at the corners, one of them now held by a boy who sucked from the plastic, beaming. A man, his arms nearly black from sun, squatted in the street. He worked over a cutting board no larger than his palm, halved a roasted chicken with a single deft cleaver blow, then distributed the slippery pieces to a flock of waiting kids. Between string lights hung low from balconies on each side of the street, I glimpsed a makeshift stage. On it, a group of elaborately dressed women gyrated, their arms colorful banners in the breeze, singing karaoke. Their voices broke off and floated down the street. Nearby, a small TV, propped on a plastic white dining table, displayed the lyrics to a Vietnamese pop song from the 80s. You're already Vietnamese. I hovered closer, still dazed from sleep. It seemed the city had forgotten the time, or rather, forgotten time itself. From what I knew, there was no holiday, no occasion for jubilation. In fact, just beyond the street where the main road began, the roads were empty, quiet as they should have been at that hour. All the commotion was contained on a single block, where people now laughed and sang. Children, some young as 5, ran through swaying adults. Grandmothers in paisley and floral pajamas sat on plastic footstools by doorways, chewing on toothpicks, whose heads stopped bobbing to the music only to shout at the kids around them. In the ground, Lan is already Vietnamese. It was only when I came close enough to see their features, the jutted and heavy jawlines, the low forward brows, did I realize the singers were in drag. Their sequined outfits of varying cuts and primary colors sparkled so intensely it seemed they were donning the very reduction of stars. I remember my father, which is to say I am cuffing him with these little words. I am giving him to you with hands behind his back, his head ducking into the patrol car, because like the table, this was how it was given to me, from mouths that never articulated the sounds inside a book. To the right of the stage were four people with their backs to everyone else. Heads bowed, they were the only ones not moving, as if enclosed in an invisible room. They stared at something on a long plastic table in front of them, their heads so low they looked decapitated. After a while, one of them, a woman with silver hair, rested her head on the shoulder of a young man to her right and began to weep. I remember getting a letter from my father while he was in prison. The envelope wrinkled, torn at the edges. I remember holding up a piece of paper covered with lines and lines whited out where the prison guard censored his words. I remember scraping at the chalky film that lay between my father and me. Those words, nuts and bolts to a table. A table in a room with no people. I stepped closer, and that's when I saw, on the table, impossibly still, the distinct form of a body covered in a white sheet. By now, all four mourners were openly weeping, while on stage, the singer's falsetto cut through their racked sobs. Nauseous, I searched the starless sky. A plane blinked red, then white, then blurred behind a band of clouds. I remember studying my father's letter and seeing a scatter of tiny black dots, the periods left untouched. A vernacular of silence. I remember thinking everyone I ever loved was a single black dot on a bright page. I remember drawing a line from one dot to another, with a name on each one, until I ended with a family tree that looked more like a barbed wire fence. I remember tearing it to shreds. Later, I would learn that this was a common scene on a Saigon night. City coroners, underfunded, don't always work around the clock. When someone dies in the middle of the night, they get trapped in a municipal limbo where the corpse remains inside its death. As a response, a grassroots movement was formed as a communal salve. Neighbors, having learned of a sudden death, would, in under an hour, pool money and hire a troupe of drag performers for what was called delaying sadness. In Saigon, the sound of music and children playing this late in the night is a sign of death, or rather, a sign of a community attempting to heal. It's through the drag performers' explosive outfits and gestures, their overdrawn faces and voices, their tabooed trespass of gender, that this relief through extravagant spectacle is manifest. As much as they are useful, paid, and empowered as a vital service in a society where to be queer is still a sin, the drag queens are, for as long as the dead lie in the open, in othered performance. Their presumed reliable fraudulence is what makes their presence to the mourners necessary. Because grief, at its worst, is unreal, and it calls for a surreal response. The queens, in this way, are unicorns. Unicorns stamping in a graveyard. I remember the table, how flames started to lick at its edges. I remember my first Thanksgiving. I was at Junior's house. Lan had made me a plate of fried egg rolls to bring over. I remember a house filled with over 20 people. people who slapped the table when they laughed. I remember food being piled on my plate. Mashed potatoes, turkey, cornbread, chitlins, greens, sweet potato pie, and egg rolls. Everyone praising Lan's egg rolls as they dipped them in gravy. How I, too, dipped them in gravy. I remember Junior's mother putting a black plastic circle on a wooden machine. How the circle spun and spun until music happened. How music was the sound of a woman wailing. How everyone closed their eyes and tilted their heads as if listening to a secret message. I remember thinking I'd heard this before, from my mother and grandmother. Yes, I heard this even inside the womb. It was the Vietnamese lullaby, how every lullaby began with wailing, as if pain could not exit the body any other way. I remember swaying while listening to my grandmother's voice crooning through the machine, how Junior's father slapped me on the shoulder. What you know about Etta James? I remember happiness. I remember my first year in an American school, the trip to the farm, how afterward, Mr. Zapadia gave each student a ditto of a black and white cow. Color in what you saw today, he said. I remember seeing how sad the cows were at the farm, their large heads lolled behind electric fences. And because I was six, I remember believing color was a kind of happiness. So I took the brightest shades in the crayon box and filled my sad cow with purple, orange, red, auburn, magenta, pewter, fuchsia, glittered gray, lime green. I remember Mr. Zapadia shouting, his beard trembling above me as a hairy hand grabbed my rainbow cow and crushed it in its fingers. I said, color in what you saw. I remember doing it over. I remember leaving my cow blank and staring out the window. How the sky was blue and merciless. How I sat there among my peers, unreal. In that street, beside the lifeless person who was somehow more animated in stillness than the living. The perpetual stench of sewage and runoff that lined the gutters. My vision blurred. The colors pooled under my lids. Passers-by offered sympathetic nods, thinking I was part of the family. As I rubbed my face, a middle-aged man gripped my neck, the way Vietnamese fathers or uncles often do when trying to pour their strength into you. You'll see her again. Hey, hey. His voice croaked and stung with alcohol. You gonna see her? He slapped the back of my neck. Don't cry. Don't cry. This man, this white man, this Paul who swings open the wooden garden gate, the metal latch clanking behind him, is not my grandfather by blood, but by action. Why did he volunteer in Vietnam when so many boys were heading to Canada to dodge the draft? I know he never told you, because he would have had to explain his abstract and implacable love of the trumpet in a language he would falter in. How he wanted, as he claimed, to be a white Miles Davis from the backwoods and cornfields of rural Virginia. How the trumpet's fat notes reverberated through the two-story farmhouse of his boyhood, the one with its doors torn clean off by a father who raged through the rooms, terrorizing his family. The father whose only connection to Paul was metal. The shell lodged in his old man's brain from the day he stormed Omaha Beach. The brass Paul lifted to his mouth to make music. I remember the table. How I tried to give it back to you. How you held me in your arms and brushed my hair, saying, there, there, it's okay, it's okay. But this is a lie. It went more like this. I gave you the table, Ma. which is to say I handed you my rainbow cow, pulled out from the wastebasket when Mr. Zapadia wasn't looking. How the colors moved and crinkled in your hands. How I tried to tell you, but did not have the language you would understand. Do you understand? I was a gaping wound in the middle of America, and you were inside me asking, where are we? Where are we, baby? I remember looking at you for a long time, and because I was six, I thought I could simply transmit my thoughts into your head, if I stared hard enough. I remember crying in rage, how you had no idea, how you put your hand underneath my shirt and scratched my back anyways. I remember sleeping like that, calmed, my crushed cow expanding on the nightstand like a slow-motion color bomb. Paul played music to get away, and when his old man tore up his application for music school, Paul got even further, all the way to the enlistment office, and found himself at 19 in Southeast Asia. They say everything happens for a reason, but I can't tell you why the dead always outnumber the living. I can't tell you why some monarchs, on their way south, simply stop flying, their wings all of a sudden too heavy, not entirely their own, and fall away, deleting themselves from the story. I can't tell you why, on the street in Saigon, as a corpse lay under the sheet, I kept hearing not the song in the drag singer's throat, but the one inside my own. Many men, many, 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 many men, wished death upon me. The street throbbed and spun its shredded colors around me. In the commotion, I noticed the body had shifted. The head fell to one side, pulling the sheet with it and revealing the nape of a neck, already pale. And there, just under the ear, no larger than a fingernail, a jade earring dangled, then stopped. Lord, I don't cry no more. Don't look to the sky no more. Have mercy on me. Blood in my eye, dog, and I can't see. I remember you grabbing my shoulders, how it was pouring rain, or it was snowing, or the streets were flooded, or the sky was the color of bruises, and you were kneeling on the sidewalk, tying my powder blue shoes, saying, remember, remember, you're already Vietnamese, you're already, you're all ready, already gone. I remember the sidewalk. How we pushed the rusty cart to the church and soup kitchen on New Britain Avenue. I remember the sidewalk, how it started to bleed, little drops of rouge appearing beneath the cart. How there was a trail of blood ahead of us and behind us. Someone must have been shot or stabbed the night before. How we kept going. You said, don't look down, baby. Don't look down. The church so far away, the steeple a stitch in the sky. Don't look down. Don't look down. I remember red, 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 red. Your hands wet over mine. Red, 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 red. Your hand so hot, your hand my own. I remember you saying, little dog, look up. Look up. See? Do you see the birds in the trees? I remember it was February. The trees were black and bare against an overcast sky. But you kept talking. Look, the birds. So many colors. Bluebirds, red birds, magenta birds, glittered birds. Your finger pointed to the twisted branches. Don't you see the nest of yellow chicks? The green mother feeding them worms? I remember how your eyes widened. I remember staring and staring at the end of your finger until, at last, an emerald blur ripened into realness. And I saw them. The birds. All of them. how they flourished like fruit as your mouth opened and closed, and the words wouldn't stop coloring the trees. I remember forgetting the blood. I remember never looking down. Yes, there was a war. Yes, we came from its epicenter. In that war, a woman gifted herself a new name, Lan. In that naming, claimed herself beautiful, then made that beauty into something worth keeping. From that, a daughter was born, and from that daughter, a son. All this time, I told myself we were born from war. But I was wrong, Ma. We were born from beauty. Let no one mistake us for the fruit of violence, but that violence, having passed through the fruit, failed to spoil it. Paul is behind me by the gate, clipping a bushel of mint leaves to garnish the pesto. His scissors snap at the stems. A squirrel hurries down from a nearby sycamore, stops at the base, sniffs the air, then doubles back, vanishing up the branches. You're just ahead as I approach. My shadow touches your heels. Little dog, you say, without turning, the sun long gone from the garden. Come here and look at this. You point to the ground at your feet, your voice a whisper shout. Isn't this crazy? I remember the room, how it burned because Lan sung a fire, surrounded by her daughters. Smoke rising and collecting in the corners, the table in the middle a bright blaze, the women with their eyes closed and the words relentless, the walls a moving screen of images flashing as each verse descended to the next. A sunlit intersection in a city no longer there. A city with no name, a white man standing beside a tank with his black-haired daughter in his arms. A family sleeping in a bomb crater. A family hiding underneath a table. Do you understand? All I was given was a table. A table in lieu of a house. A table in lieu of history. There was a house in Saigon, you told me. One night, your father, drunk, came home and beat me for the first time at the kitchen table. You were not born yet. But I remember the table anyway. It exists and does not exist. An inheritance assembled with bare mouths and nouns and ash. I remember the table as a shard embedded in the brain, how some will call it shrapnel, and some will call it art. I am at your side now, as you point at the ground, where, just beyond your toes, a colony of ants pours across the dirt patch, a flood of black animation so thick it resembles the shadow of a person that won't materialize. I can't make out the individuals. Their bodies linked to one another in an incessant surge of touch. Each six-legged letter dark blue in the dusk, fractals of a time-worn alphabet. No, these are not monarchs. They are the ones who, come winter, will stay, will turn their flesh into seeds and burrow deeper, only to break through the warm spring loam, ravenous. I remember the walls curling like a canvas as the fire blazed, the ceiling a rush of black smoke. I remember crawling to the table, how it was now a pile of soot, then dipping my fingers into it, my nails blackening with my country. My country dissolving on my tongue, I remember cupping the ash and writing the words live, live, live on the foreheads of the three women sitting in the room. How the ash eventually hardened into ink on a blank page. How there's ash on this very page. How there's enough for everyone. You straighten up, dust off your pants. Night drains all colors from the garden. We walk, shadowless, toward the house. Inside, in the glow of shaded lamps, we roll up our sleeves, wash our hands. We speak, careful not to look too long at one another. Then, with no words left between us, we set the table. I hear it in my dream. Then, eyes open, I hear it again. The low wail swooping across the raised fields. An animal. Always it is an animal whose pain is this articulate, this clear. I'm lying on the barn's cool dirt floor. Above me, rows of tobacco hang, their limbs brushing against one another in a lone draft, which means it's the third week of August. Through the slats, a new day, already thick with summer's heat. The sound comes back, and this time I sit up. It's not until I see him that I know I'm 15 again. Trevor's asleep beside me. On his side, his arm a pillow, he looks more lost in thought than in sleep. His breath slow and eased, cut with hints of the paps we drank a few hours ago, the empties lined along on the bench above his head. A few feet away lies the metal army helmet, tipped back, the morning light, powder blue, collected in the bowl. Still in my boxers, I walk out into the vast haze. The howl returns, the sound deep and vacuous, as if it had walls, something you could hide in. It must be wounded. Only something in pain could make a sound you could enter. I search the flattened fields. Mist wafts across the brown and tarnished soil. Nothing. It must be coming from the next farm. I walk. The humidity rises. My temples itch with new sweat. In the next field, the last of the tobacco, fat and dark green, a week away from harvest, rises on all sides, somehow higher than usual, their tips just above my head. There's the oak, where we'll total the Chevy in 2 weeks. The crickets have yet to unhinge their legs and now serrate the dense air as I go deeper, stopping each time the bellow shoots up, louder, closer. Last night, under the rafters, our lips raw and spent from use, we lay breathing. The dark quiet between us, I asked Trevor what Lon had asked me the week before. You ever think about those buffaloes on the Discovery Channel? I mean, how they keep running off those cliffs? He turned to me. His lip fuzz brushed my arm.
The buffaloes?
Yeah. How come they keep running like that? Even after the ones in front of them fall off? You'd think one of them would stop, would turn around. His hand, tanned by work, was surprisingly dark on his stomach.
Yeah, I've seen them on the nature shows. They just tumble off like a load of bricks, right down.
He clicked his tongue in disgust, but his voice dropped off.
Idiots.
We were still, letting the buffaloes go on falling, hundreds of them trotting silently down the cliffs in our heads. Somewhere in the next field, a pickup pulled into a driveway. Gravel under the tires, a beam swung against the barn and lighted the dust above our noses. His eyes shut, eyes that I knew by then were no longer gray, but Trevor. The door slammed and someone came home and low voices could be heard. The single lilt of a question as it rose. How was it? Or, are you hungry? Something plain and necessary, yet extra, with care. A voice like those tiny roofs over the phone booths along the train tracks, the ones made from the same shingles used for houses, except only 4 rows wide, just enough to keep the phone dry.
And maybe that's all I wanted. To be asked a question and have it cover me, like a roof the width of myself.
It's not up to them, Trevor said.
What's not?
The damn buffaloes.
He flicked the metal buckle on his belt.
It ain't up to them where they go.
It's Mother Nature.
She tells them to jump, and they go on and do it.
They don't got no choice about it. It's just the law of nature. The law, I repeated under my breath. Like they're just following their loved ones. Like their family's just going forward, and they go with them.
Yeah, something like that, he said with sleepiness.
Like a family. A fucked family. I felt this sudden surge of tenderness for him right then. A feeling so rare in me back then, it felt like I was being displaced by it. Until Trevor pulled me back.
Hey, he said, half asleep.
What were you before you met me?
I think I was drowning.
A pause. And what are you now? He whispered, sinking. I thought for a second.
Water.
Fuck off. He punched me on the arm. And go to sleep, little dog. Then he grew quiet. Then his eyelashes. You could hear them think. I don't know what made me follow the hurt thing's voice, but I was pulled, as if promised an answer to a question I had not yet possessed. They say if you want something bad enough, you'll end up making a god out of it. But what if all I ever wanted was my life, Ma? I am thinking of beauty again. How some things are hunted because we have deemed them beautiful. If, relative to the history of our planet, an individual life is so short, a blink of an eye, as they say, then to be gorgeous, even from the day you're born to the day you die, is to be gorgeous only briefly. Like right now, how the sun is coming on, low behind the elms. And I can't tell the difference between a sunset and a sunrise. The world, reddening, appears the same to me, and I lose track of east and west. The colors this morning have the frayed tint of something already leaving. I think of the time Trev and I sat on the tool shed roof, watching the sun sink. I wasn't so much surprised by its effect. How, in a few crushed minutes, it changes the way things are seen, including ourselves, but that it was ever mine to see. Because the sunset, like survival, exists only on the verge of its own disappearing. To be gorgeous, you must first be seen, but to be seen allows you to be hunted. I hear her call again, convinced now that it's a heifer. Ranchers often sell off the calves at night, ferrying them away on truck beds while the mothers slept in their stalls so they wouldn't wake up screaming for their babies. Some would wail so hard their throats would swell shut and a balloon had to be placed inside and inflated to expand the neck muscles. I get closer. The tobacco stands high. When she wails again, the sound parts the stalks and the leaves shiver. I approach the small clearing where she is. The light froths blue over the plant tips. I hear her huge lungs working for air, soft but clear as wind. I part the thick-packed plants and step forward.
Ma, tell me the story again. I'm too tired, baby. Tomorrow, back to sleep.
I wasn't sleeping. It's past 10, and you're just back from the salon. You have a towel wrapped around your hair, your skin still warm from the shower.
Come on, real quick, the one about the monkey.
You sigh, slipping under the blanket.
All right, but give me a cigarette.
I take one from the carton on the nightstand, place it between your lips and light. You puff once, twice, I take it out. Watch you.
Okay, let's see. Once upon a time, there was a monkey king who...
No, Ma. The real one. Come on, tell the real life story.
I put the cigarette back in your mouth. Let you puff. Okay. Your eyes searched the room. Once upon a time... Scoot closer. You want to hear it or not? Once upon a time, in the old country, there were men who would eat the brains of monkeys.
You were born in the year of the monkey. So you're a monkey.
Yeah, I guess so, you whisper, staring far away. I'm a monkey. The cigarette smolders between my fingers. Mist rises from the warm soil as I step through the crop. The sky widens. The tobacco drops off, revealing a circle no larger than God's thumbprint. But nothing's here. No cow, no sound, only the last crickets far off now. The tobacco still in the morning air. I stand waiting for the sound to make me true. Nothing. The heifer, the farm, the boy, the wreck, the war. Had I made it all up, in a dream, only to wake up with it fused to my skin? Ma, I don't know if you made it this far in this letter, or if you made it here at all. You always tell me it's too late for you to read, with your poor liver, your exhausted bones, that after everything you've been through, you'd just like to rest now. That reading is a privilege you made possible for me with what you lost. I know you believe in reincarnation. I don't know if I do, but I hope it's real. Because then maybe you'll come back here next time around. Maybe you'll be a girl, and maybe your name will be Rose again. And you'll have a room full of books with parents who will read you bedtime stories in a country not touched by war. Maybe then, in that life and in this future, you'll find this book and you'll know what happened to us. And you'll remember me. Maybe. For no reason, I start to run. Past the clearing, back into the tobacco's stiff shade. My feet blurring into a small wind beneath me, I run. Even if no one I know is dead yet. Not Trevor, not Lon, not my friends with the speed and heroin nowhere near their scarless veins. Even if the farm is not yet sold to make room for luxury condos, the barn not yet dismantled, its wood repurposed into craft furniture or to line the walls of trendy cafes in Brooklyn, I run. I run thinking I will outpace it all. My will to change being stronger than my fear of living. My chest wet and leaf raked, the day smoldering up at its edges. I push through so fast I feel like I've finally broken out of my body, left it behind. But when I turn around to see the panting boy, to forgive him at last for trying and failing to be good, there's no one there, only the full elms windless at the field's edge. Then, for no reason, I keep going. I think of the buffaloes somewhere, maybe in North Dakota or Montana, their shoulders rippling in slow motion as they race for the cliff, their brown bodies bottlenecked at the narrow precipice, their eyes oil black. The velvet bones of their horns covered with dust, they run headfirst together until they become moose, huge and antlered, wet nostrils braying. Then dogs, with paws clawing toward the edge, their tongues lapping in the light until, finally, they become macaques, a whole troop of them. The crowns of their heads cut open, their brains hollowed out, they float, the hair on their limbs fine and soft as feathers.
and just as the first one steps off the cliff onto air, the forever nothing below, they ignite into the ochre-red sparks of monarchs. Thousands of monarchs pour over the edge, fan into the white air, like a blood jet hitting water. I race through the field, as if my cliff was never written into this story, as if I was no heavier than the words in my name, and like a word, I hold no weight in this world, yet still carry my own life. And I throw it ahead of me, until what I left behind becomes exactly what I'm running toward, like I'm part of a family. Why didn't they get you then? I place the Marlboro back in your mouth. You hold my hand there for a while, breathe, then take it between your fingers. Oh, little dog, you sigh. Little dog, little dog. Monkeys, moose, cows, dogs, butterflies, buffaloes. What we would give to have the ruined lives of animals tell a human story, when our lives are in themselves the story of animals. Why didn't they get me? Well, 'cause I was fast, baby. Some monkeys are so fast, they're more like ghosts, you know? They just poof. You open your palm in a gesture of a small explosion. Disappear. Without moving your head, you look at me the way a mother looks at anything for too long. Then, for no reason, you start to laugh. The past tense of sing is not singed. Hua Win. This is Ocean Wong. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous. This program was directed by Robert Kessler, executive producer Linda Korn, and engineered by Peter Acker. Text copyright 2019 by Ocean Wong. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.